This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Myths and conspiracy theories. That's what we're about to get into, and heavily at that. Stay right there. Tell you what, let's start out easily in the myth and conspiracy side of things, shall we? This would be an easy one, really. You know, for a lot of years now, I've listened to people talk about the fact that we never went to the moon. A lot of people think we never went to the moon, right? They have prevailed upon us for a very long time. Wayne Green was one of those people, and there were many others, people who just thought we never went to the moon. Man never did it. Well, a European spacecraft now orbiting the moon could turn out to be a kind of a time machine, well, in a way, as it photographs old landing sites of Soviet robotic probes and, of course, areas where American Apollo crews sat down and even explored. New imagery of old Apollo touchdown spots from the European Space Agency's Smart One probe might just put to rest conspiratorial thoughts that the U.S. astronauts didn't go the distance and scuff up the lunar landscape. They're going to prove it. They're going to take pictures of it. Fringe theorists have said that images of the waving flag, oh, you remember that one, right? On a moon with no atmosphere and other oddities show that NASA never really went to the moon at all. No serious scientist or spaceflight historian doubts the success of the Apollo program, but we are observing some of the landing sites for calibration and ground truth purposes. That's what he said. What does that mean? Let's think about that statement. We're observing some of the landing sites for calibration. That I get. Calibration, in other words, geographically where these spots are, and ground truth purposes. That was the chief scientist of the ESA science program, ground truth purposes. That means to perhaps reveal to those who have been chattering in our ear with these conspiracy theories all these years that they're whack and we really did land on the moon. I certainly think we landed on the moon. I also think that our own government, that President Bush, our president, whatever I think of the president, I'm no fan of his. You just heard me take off on the Social Security thing a little while ago. I did not vote for the president, which I've told you before. Does that shock you? Well, anyway, it's the truth. I didn't. So I'm no great fan of the presidents, nor many other presidents, for that matter. I was a big fan of Ronald Reagan's, but not really this president. Nor am I anti-Bush particularly either. It depends on the issue. Now, in the case of Social Security, I just told you what I thought a little while ago, but in the case of 9-11, when these horrible men took those airplanes and plowed them into U.S. assets and took American thousands of American lives and brought down the World Trade Center buildings and crashed into the Pentagon and took another plane that passengers on the plane courageously crashed before they could do their evil deed, whatever it was, the White House, whatever they had in mind. I pretty much, you see, believe that it came down the way it seemed to come down. Occam's razor, the most likely thing seems to be true. We know the planes hit the buildings. I know, anyway. It's my belief that they really hit the buildings. It's my belief that the president of these United States, George Bush, or any other president that I've known, even Dick Nixon, would never order thousands of their own citizens killed in such a horrible attack on America. And I don't for one second, not one second, do I believe any of it. And oh, baby, have I taken grief for that position. Let me read you a few emails that have come in the last, few days. Okay? This is from Lon C. in Florida. Lon C. says, "Hey, Art, why won't you talk about 9/11? Art, who bought you out? Or are you just another mindless government mouthpiece? How come you're not answering the 10 questions sent to you by Victor Thrawn? How many times have you read a piece entitled 25 Rules of Disinformation? You keep being the poster boy for the New World Order. People like you and the other neocons in the mainstream media make me sick. Wake up, Art, and take off the rose-colored glasses. 9/11 was an inside job." Lon C. in Florida. Or this one. This is from Michael Ferreira of Wing TV, Wingnut TV, I call it. Michael Ferreira, he's been peppering me with these nasty emails for months now. He says, in this particular one that came tonight, he says, "Art, you're a traitor. You're a coward. You're a sellout of America. Defend yourself, traitor." That's what Michael says to me most times when he writes stuff like that. Little doesn't go beyond that usually. "You're a traitor. You're a coward. You're a sellout of America. Defend yourself, traitor." Or how about this from Penny? Penny says, "The fires of hell are made to roast lying whores like you." Art, the fires of hell are made to roast lying whores like you. Let me see. This is from Jack. Jack doesn't say where he is. He said, Jack says, "I see you're preparing to have the Popular Mechanics government disinformation," that's in parentheses, "view of 9/11 on tonight. Will there be an opposing point of view, Art?" "I doubt it, except perhaps from the listeners. You've gone, Art, from being a pioneer to being a toady for this lying, fascist, neocon government. Anyone with a modicum of intelligence will realize the government's claims are lies, and that Popular Mechanics picked which claims they chose to debunk. The 9/11 Commission's report should occupy the same garbage can as the Warren Commission report. Thank God George Norrie has some courage and is not sold out. Why has your intellect and courage failed you, Art?" And then, let's see, this is Jerry. Jerry writes, "Hey, Art, since you're going to have Ben Chertoff on as a guest this Saturday, well, how about giving equal time to the other side and have Alex Jones on as a guest? George has the nerve to have him on. Do you? Better yet, why not have both Alex Jones and Ben Chertoff on at the same time and have a debate? Regards, Jerry." And then to follow that up, I got a call from our producer this afternoon who said, "Hey, Art, you're not going to believe this. Dave Von Kleist," he's another Alex Jones type. Dave Von Kleist, a publicist, has called and is wanting equal time tonight. Now, let's think about this a little bit. Alex Jones, Dave Von Kleist. Now, am I wrong here, or didn't George have Alex Jones on all by himself? Didn't he? Well, was there anybody there to debate him or debunk him when Alex told his story? Why, no, there wasn't. Wait, he also had Dave Von Kleist on, right? All by himself, with nobody there to point out what they felt was wrong with what he was saying. Right? These are two 9/11 conspiratorial researchers. Right? Alex Jones, I think, is a talk show host on his own. Dave Van Kleist, anyway, 9/11 in plain sight. So, they've both been on all by themselves, I do believe. Is that not true? Why? Yes, of course it is. And so, why in heaven's name would I be required to have somebody on to argue with my guest tonight who's got his point of view? I don't know, I'm just curious about that. I got so many emails saying, you're going to have one without having somebody to say the other side of the story? You mean the other side of the story hasn't been told on this program? Gee, where have you folks been? You know it has. So tonight, Popular Mechanics is going to, and they did a pretty good job. You know, they went to the Bureau of Standards, was one of their big sources. They went to a lot of scientists, a lot of engineers. They interviewed them about perhaps at least the 16 most popular conspiratorial wingnut theories. And they're going to debunk them as first time, as far as I know, that this side of it has even been aired on this program. So I think that it's more than fair. Absolutely more than fair. Now, here's something else interesting that has occurred. Over on the Jeff Rentz website, all of a sudden, late today, in a panic, appeared the article by, who did this? Christopher Bolin, I think it is. The headline is, Bell hosts Popular Mechanics Mag 9/11 debunker. And I'll read this whole article, and we're going to let Benjamin respond to it. But basically, the tenets are that he's the cousin of Michael Chertoff. Now, I asked Benjamin about that a little bit earlier. Indeed, it probably is true. He might be the 14th millionth distant removed cousin of Michael, who's the new Homeland Defense Director. So there may indeed be a relationship there, you know, but so what? As a matter of fact, I don't even think that Benjamin knew there was a relationship until it was pointed out to him today. Then, like so many articles on the Rentz site that appear from time to time, I think it's clearly, in my opinion, an anti-Semitic website. Let's see. At the bottom of this article by Bolin on the Rentz site, it says, controlled press hides Chertoff's Israeli roots. Really? Let's see. Claims that there are ties, Michael's ties, that would be Michael many times removed from Benjamin, Michael's ties to Israel and the Mossad. So these will be things that this night I will ask Benjamin about. I'm not afraid of asking anything of anybody, contrary to what these wingnuts who've been sending me these kinds of messages believe. I'll ask anybody anything. And as a matter of fact, I'll give all of you an opportunity to ask anything you would like. This is going to be one particular point of view tonight. And the point of view is that what you believe was true about 9/11 is in fact true in terms of at least how it happened. Now, the conspiracy behind doing it and those who did it and why they did it, we haven't unraveled all of that yet, have we? But the fact that it was people mostly from different foreign countries is probably going to end up to be true. That they took airplanes, smashed them into the buildings, I think is going to end up to be true and already has in my mind. And people who would say that the President of the United States, George Bush, ordered this attack on his own country, I think are off their nuts. Okay? So call me what you will, traitor. And all the other names that you've laid on me there, call me what you will, that is what I will continue to believe. And I think people like you, all you people who have written me these type of things, are off your nuts. That's what I think. I think it's a fringe group that is formed with a gathering. It's like a snowball rolling downhill, getting to be bigger and bigger and bigger, and I think it's nutty. Nevertheless, this night we will have Benjamin Chertoff on, and he will certainly answer questions on the telephone from all of you, even the kinds of questions that may not be covered in the 9/11 report in Popular Mechanics. I'm sure it goes beyond these 16 things, but it'll be your opportunity to say what you want to say. I'm not afraid of anybody or anything. And what I tell you is what I believe to be the truth. And I frequently then, of course, will get, well, gee, you can believe in all kinds of other things like UFOs. Well, believe, and I do believe in UFOs because I've seen one. But I don't think I've ever told you I believe absolutely, because I don't, that what I saw was an alien craft. I have said again and again and again, people don't listen because they hear what they want to hear, that it was either an alien craft or it was a U.S. military test aircraft. Either way, I have said it's a big damn story. It is a big story, but it doesn't mean that I 100% believe there are aliens. I don't know. Till I see one myself, I've seen an unidentified flying object. That much I can personally attest to. The rest of it, no. But I will allow people to come on the program and say what they like, and you, many times, in rebuttal, what you would like. That's the kind of open forum this has always been and remains. And again, I feel that having this guest on tonight is no different than having Alex Jones on by himself, or Mr. Van Kleist by himself, or any of the others that George has had on with that point of view. And with that in mind, this program owes the audience, perhaps, from my point of view, a little sanity. All that said, here we go. Open lines. First time caller line, you are on the air. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi. You're on the air, my dear. Where are you calling from?
State College, Pennsylvania.
Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a question about the molten steel.
Okay, well, go. You're a little early. I mean, the guy to really answer this is about to be on the air. But what is your question?
Well, the pools of molten steel were burning 70 feet below the street level for about 100 days after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And jet fuel burns off within a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we saw the black plumes of smoke rising,
mm-hmm.
because it was the fires were starving. My question is, if it takes 5,182 degrees Fahrenheit to make steel into a liquid molten state, then I would like to know how hydrocarbon fires, which can't burn in an oxygen-starved environment, as these underground fires did, how this could have happened. How does he explain the pools of molten steel burning 70 feet below street level?
All right, I can assure you we're going to get to all of that. We are going to get to all of that. We're going to talk about the temperature that steel will begin to melt at, and more importantly, we're going to talk about the temperature at which steel will begin to weaken.
Right.
And they're very different temperatures.
Oh, there. I know that. I know that. I, you know, we've discussed this at length in 9/11 on trial, Victor Thorne's book, and also you could ask him, too, the collapses of the towers defy Galileo's law of falling bodies and also Isaac Newton's first law of motion. The second tower defies Isaac Newton's law of motion. The cap of that tower tipped to the east 23 degrees past vertical and then reversed direction and then fell vertically into its own footprint.
Well, okay,
and
no
if
matter,
gravity is the only force acting upon that up there,
then
what
you're saying
caused
it's possible.
That?
Yeah, well, okay. I'll try and remember those things to ask when...
Can I blast those to you?
Well, of course.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
Do
you.
That, and that'll help me remember. All right, coming up in a moment, you'll just stay right where you are. It's going to get pretty rough around here. Ben Chertoff is coming up. He's the top dog in this category for a magazine that I've always enjoyed, Popular Mechanics, and we're going to talk about 9/11 from a scientific perspective. We'll be right back.
talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Oh, baby, here they come. Darren in Lansing, Michigan writes, "Hey, Art, you're really brilliant to insult your listeners, aren't you? Keep calling those of us names who believe September 11th was a U.S. government operation. Insulting your listeners is a sure way to keep folks tuning in." Oh, nonsense, Darren. That's nothing but a few out there with IQs approaching that of a, I don't know, an eggplant or something. And if they're gone, it won't be a substantive part of the audience at all. We'll be right back. All right, here we go. As research editor for Popular Mechanics, Benjamin Chertoff is responsible for upholding journalistic standards for the magazine, as well as ensuring all the stories in Popular Mechanics are reported completely and accurately. He is the senior reporter for the magazine's special March feature, 9/11, Debunking the Myths, managing a team of dogged and intrepid professional researchers and reporters. Before he joined Popular Mechanics in the summer of 2004, Ben worked as a freelance reporter and researcher for a number of large circulation magazines and publications, most notably, Men's Journal, where he specialized in verifying and bolstering reportage from the early days of the Iraq War. In addition to his reporting, Ben has written extensively about health and science news, as well as general interest features and profiles. And where I feel we should begin is with this article. And so what I'm going to do, Ben, is I'm going to read it and then on the air and then let you respond to it before we even get started, all right?
That would be fine, Art.
Good. All right, here we go. Let's see. Headline on this Rents site, Bell hosts Popular Mechanics Mag, a 9/11 debunker, Saturday, March 5th. As your Coast to Coast network website says about the upcoming Art Bell Show, research editor for Popular Mechanics magazine, Ben Chertoff, will discuss the 16 most prevalent claims made by conspiratorial theorists regarding 9/11 and how the staff of Popular Mechanics debunked each of them. Cousin of Michael Chertoff. Because Benjamin Chertoff is a cousin of Michael Chertoff, the new head of the Department of Homeland Security, a massive bureaucratic security agency created as a result of 9/11, I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you condone the flagrant and undemocratic nepotism of the Bush administration, for example, this Chertoff connection, whereby a senior government official's cousin has written a propaganda piece supporting the government's seriously flawed and incomplete investigation of the events of 9/11? This is the kind of thing that Saddam Hussein was known for. This is not very American and at all honest journalism. Will you ask Ben Chertoff about the journalistic ethics practiced by Hearst Corporation and Popular Mechanics, in which a cousin of the Homeland Security Czar has produced a major propaganda piece in Popular Mechanics, which clearly seeks to discredit the citizens' 9/11 investigation and calls serious researchers like myself, Eric Schumfield, David von Kleist, liars and extremists? Will you ask Ben, Popular Mechanics senior researcher, about how secondary fires, in other words, burning office furniture, supplies, and paper, induced the collapse of the Twin Towers, as the FEMA building performance study conducted by a team headed by Dr. Gene Corley during 1 week concluded, including the complete collapse of the tower's 47 central columns, source executive summary by Gene Corley, blah, 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 blah. I would advise you to ask him why the Windsor Building in Madrid endured a 24-hour inferno with temperatures of 1,000 degrees Celsius without collapsing on February, that's got to be 12, 13, 2005. Will you, on Coast to Coast Radio, ask Ben about his relationship with his cousin Michael Chertoff, and will you also ask about Mike's dual national status as an Israeli national by virtue of the fact that his mother was a first hostess with Israel's LL Airlines and a Mossad operative in 1949 and 50 during Operation Magic Carpet. Tip. Ben's mom told me that Ben is a cousin of Michael Chertoff, the secretary of DHS. Ben's mom, Judy Dargan, can be reached in Pelham, New York, where Ben graduated from high school in 1998. Judy told me that Ben's dad is Larry Chertoff. I think he's a senior executive with the New York EPA and deals with water issues, but I haven't confirmed that. For more information about Benjamin Chertoff and his ties to Michael Chertoff and Michael's ties to Israel and the Mossad, please read the following. 9/11 and Chertoff. Cousin wrote 9/11 propaganda for PM. Controlled press hides Chertoff's Israeli roots. Will Art Bell ask Ben Chertoff about his ties to DHS? That pretty well covers it. He does say, Mr. Bell, I'll be listening. If you fail to openly address and discuss these essential and troublesome facts, I will be forced to accept the conclusion that you are also part of the 9/11 cover-up. Respectively, Christopher Bullitt. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Now, let's address some of what was said in this panicked piece that was put up so quickly on the website.
Sure.
Where would you like to begin? I just read the whole thing. I mean, what's true and what's false?
Well, I'll tell you, I never thought I'd be compared to Uday and Kuse.
Yeah, that was a little rough.
I'm not sure if I, you know, wear that as a badge of honor. Well, I mean, first of all, my connection to Michael Chertoff. I found out who Michael Chertoff was actually after we had shipped this piece. When I read the New York Times, of course, in magazines, typically you're working a month or 2 months before.
No, wait a minute. You didn't even find out that you were related to Michael?
I didn't know who Michael Chertoff was until the piece went to press and I saw my last name on the cover of the New York Times. And, of course, it's not a very common last name, so it jumps out at you on the subway.
So what did you do, call Mom and say, hey, Mom, what's the deal?
Well, actually, I called my father and we chatted about it. And, you know, there aren't many Chertoffs. It's a very uncommon name, so in all likelihood there probably is a relation. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know.
Oh, you mean you're not even absolutely positive?
No, not at all. No. I mean, we traced our family tree back as far as we could. And if there is a connection, it's probably in 19th century Belarus, where the family sort of split into two groups, and they didn't talk ever since. So
I see.
If I am a cousin, and what my mother had said on the phone after Chris Bowman had tracked her down and called numerous times, what she did say was that she thought I might be a distant cousin. But, of course, that has turned into direct cousin. But never met him, never spoken to him.
And the Mossad thing?
You're going to have to ask Michael Chertoff.
I see.
I have no idea.
Man, I'll tell you, all kinds of articles on that rent site are Jew this, Jew that. All right. Let's get down, having disposed with that then, let's get down to business here. I mean, first of all, even if you are related and you're still not sure, you didn't find out until after you dealt with this article anyway. So,
yeah, it was as we were going to press with it.
So there you go. All right. So what made you and or Popular Mechanics decide to pursue this madness anyway?
Well, what happened was, this is going back to October when the idea came up, we opened up the New York Times one day, and there was a half-page ad. In fact, I think there were a number of ads. I think this was actually a full-page ad for one of the groups out in California. I think it's a reopen911.org. I might be mixing that up. But there was an ad, advertisement, for a book called Painful Questions, mm-hmm. and it listed on this advertisement all these anomalies in the physics of the collapse of the World Trade Centers. And they, you know, they cited these as things that the media, the mainstream media, was ignoring, and these were important questions that needed to be asked.
Mm-hmm.
And they all fit within, you know, popular mechanics in, into what we do, into our field of expertise. The magazine has 102 years history reporting on military affairs, reporting on engineering, reporting on science and technology. And all these claims focused on very physical evidence, or what they were posing as physical evidence, for instance, that jet fuel doesn't burn hot enough to melt steel. So, you know, how could jet fuel have been responsible for melting the steel in the World Trade Center?
And we'll get to that. And the bottom line is, though, that popular mechanics dealt with this kind of thing. It had access to the scientists. It had access to engineers. And so you could actually take the evidence and really submit it to the real people here.
Exactly. They said that the mainstream media was ignoring it, and we looked at ourselves and thought, well, I guess we're the mainstream media.
Uh-huh.
And let's ask those questions. Let's investigate it.
All right. When did that begin? How long ago?
I guess we started the reporting back in, it was either October, it was early November when we had a team assembled and we started going out and actually picking the stuff apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it ran all the way through, through mid-January, I mean, as we were going to press. So I guess it was earlier than that.
Ben, how did you decide on what the 16 most important claims to investigate would be?
What we did was we looked through a lot of website searches and got Thierry Masson's book and got the Painful Questions book, read through all the literature and watched the DVDs and tried to pick out not only what we saw repeated the most, because we wanted to have claims that sort of represented what was out there, the most common 16 claims, but also the most plausible, because a lot of them can, a lot of the claims are sort of at face value pretty counterintuitive. So we chose the ones that seemed like there could be truth there, and we picked the ones that we saw the most.
Okay. All right. And so web research and getting the books probably in plain sight as well.
Absolutely. We watched that.
Absolutely.
A number of times.
Yeah. All right. Good. Because another one I got said, oh, you know, if you haven't seen Plain Sight, Art, then you're not going to be qualified to be interviewing Ben. So anyway, we've got, let's start. Let's just go through all damn 16 of them. This is long-form talk radio. We've got the time to do it.
Great.
Let's go through each and every one of them.
Great.
All right. So start wherever you want to.
Well, we can go in the order of the magazine, or we can any way you want.
All right, let's go with the magazine. I've got it right in front of me. The pod question.
Yeah, the pod theory shows up a lot.
What is the pod theory?
Well, there are a number of different variations on the pod theory, but essentially it focuses on what people have seen in these low-resolution stills of the plane flying into the South Tower, because remember there's very little footage of the plane flying into the North Tower.
Right.
So this is the plane that flew into the South Tower. There's plenty of cameras that track this in. It was on CNN. It was on all the major networks. They're taking, when you take a still image of these video shots, it appears in a couple of frames as the plane is flying in,
mm-hmm.
and you can watch it on the video, or you can see the freeze frames. You can there is what looks like a bulge under the right wing of the where the wing meets the fuselage of the 767 that flew into the South Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And that has turned into all sorts of different things. I mean, there are claims that it's a missile that is fired right as the plane impacts the South Tower. Perhaps it's a military tanker plane. I mean, or it's a guidance system. There are all sorts of different theories as to what this is. So what we did was we took their evidence and the evidence that was on these sites and the evidence that's put out on the major conspiracy materials, and we sent both video stills and also the clearest picture we could find, the clearest still photo which was a Rob Howard shot that originally appeared in New York Magazine. It's an incredible photo of the plane about to hit the South Tower, and we talked to Rob and we got the actual film and sent that off to imaging experts and actually to a number of imaging experts.
Is that the one you've got in the magazine here?
Yeah, that's at the opening spread.
There's All right.
That black and white photo, which I believe he didn't even know that the second plane was there. He was running down the street and had taken the camera and shot it over his head, and then that was the photo that came from it. So we took the original film and the still footage from the original CNN feed, and we sent them to as many imaging experts as we could. And we found Ronald Greeley, who is at the he's at a space photography laboratory at Arizona State University, and he his area of expertise is taking images from NASA probes and from NASA satellites and identifying on planets from this video footage and from these images based on the light formations and shadows what is actually on the surface.
Got it.
And it's a real science. So, you know, if anyone was qualified to do it, he was the one. And he took a look at it and very quickly ran it through his own computer programs and looked at the, I believe he looked at the video footage itself. And it turns out that there's nothing there, because what happens is when you have a video still, the pixels end up getting exaggerated, especially when you blow it up and you try to sharpen it.
Oh, I know.
Pixels spill into the other side. I mean, it's very inexact science to try to analyze something from a video. So,
I know. It's like trying to find stuff on Mars.
Exactly.
Same
exactly.
Problem,
which is why we tried to focus on the photograph itself. And when you looked at the photograph very quickly figured out that to a certain extent, there's sun glint, and also the plane is banked to the left. The engine is to the right of where this pod is supposed to be. And if you actually watch the footage in full motion, you can see most of it is just the shadow from the engine as it's flying into the building. But when you see it on the video, there's this enlargement effect that happens from the video, and that has turned into this pod.
So then, in every way, a standard 760.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the magazine, if you pick up a copy, you can see that we juxtapose it next to I believe it's a picture of a Qantas Airlines 767, and you can see that it's just the wing fairing that juts out. The plane is on an angle on all the shots, so it's a little difficult to see. But I mean, it's a plane, United Airlines 767.
So hogwash. No missile under there, no pod with high explosives, or I don't know what they thought it was, something like that, though, right?
Exactly, exactly. And we also talked to experts at Boeing and at we talked to a bunch of military and aviation experts about the possibility of even putting a pod on an airplane.
Yes.
Right there. And the consensus was, why would you want to do that? And B, it would be a real pain to do that. And you'd have to re-engineer the plane. I mean, I think one of our experts had said, you know, it's not just like throwing a suitcase in the trunk. You have to. These planes are very light. They're very highly engineered. And to hang something heavy off the bottom of the plane would take an enormous amount of restructuring of the actual wing.
Even so, all of that said, your expert said, here's the evidence. Here's the photograph. It wasn't. There's no pod there. There's no missile there. There's nothing. It's just a plane.
Absolutely conclusively.
All right. A lot of people think that there was a secret order that went out from, I don't know, on high, that all of the U.S. military on 9/11, when this began to happen, was ordered to stand down. Now, that's, to me, crazy on the face of it. I mean, that would involve everybody receiving orders at so many different places. Look, we have this horrible thing that we, the government, are about to do, and we're ordering you, the military, to not raise one airplane or do anything to try and stop these airplanes that are going to destroy landmarks in New York and hit the Pentagon. We want you all to stand down and not send any jets up. These people believe that, right?
Yep, and of course it would take thousands of people.
Yeah, to keep their mouths shut, right?
Exactly.
If such an order really went out. All right, hold it right there, Ben. We'll be right back. It's Bottom of the Hour. Ben Chertoff is my guest, and we're discussing 9/11. Ben is from Popular Mechanics. they would be the people who would know how to look into this. So if you want to ignore this evidence, you do so at your own peril. We'll discuss each and every one of these 16, probably more, before the night is done. Keep your dial right there.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Tonight, Ben Chertoff is here from Popular Mechanics, and he's talking about the science of the collapse of the buildings in New York and the Pentagon as well, and a whole lot of other things that are involved in the, I don't know, the crazy claims out there. We'll get back to them one by one in a moment. You know, a lot of these are technical claims made, and we're going to deal with those. But, you know, it's, to me, it's embarrassing that the second biggest claim would be no stand-down order, that our military had been virtually told to keep all the planes on the ground and not challenge people who are about to blow up our buildings. But nevertheless, there it is. No stand-down order. Deal with that one, Ben.
Well, this is one of my favorites because it's incredibly complicated. And to a certain extent, it's one of the more compelling claims that you see bounced around. It's sort of the basis of the whole theory. I mean, if the government was going to make this happen, then there would have to be some sort of stand down. It's sort of the be-all, end-all theory. But and also it shows, I mean, a lot of these conspiracies, they have such animosity towards the government, yet have this assumption that everything is going to, in the government, is going to work like clockwork. You know, if a plane is off course for just a second, it's going to be immediately intercepted by fighter jets.
Yeah.
Which, of course, on the morning of September 11th, was not the case, because NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense Command, which mm-hmm. is the military body that is responsible for protecting U.S. and Canadian airspace, that was set up during the Cold War. And the infrastructure of NORAD was looking outwards for threats. I mean, they had radar stations that run the coast, I mean, since September 11th, of course, this has all been changed quite drastically in NORAD's kind of
Of course,
second,
but prior to
life,
September 11th, they
on
were...
On that morning, yeah, exactly. On that morning, they had radar stations ringing the coast. There was no radar coverage inside. They relied on air traffic control to vector their fighter planes. And they only had, in all of North America, 20 planes on alert. In the U.S., in the contiguous 48 states, there were only 14 fighter jets on alert, and those were two up in Otis Air Force Base. I mean, in terms of the ones that were close to the World Trade Center, there were two up in Otis Air Force Base. And, of course, once the hijackings occurred, air traffic control for a long time was scratching their heads. They didn't know what was going on, because if you talk to the FAA guys, and of course we talked, they were like our best friends at one point, because we were on the phone almost every day with a new set of questions, and talked to the air traffic controllers, and also talked to the guys over at NORAD. Before September 11th, if you had simultaneous loss of transponder and radio contact, that meant one thing, and that was that the plane had crashed. So there was an initial lag time there, and NORAD got warning. I mean, the air traffic control literally had to pick up the phone and call NORAD directly and say, listen, there's something screwy with this plane, because they were able to briefly pick it up on their primary radar, air traffic control was, and said, you know, I think we have a hijack situation. And, of course, there hadn't been a domestic hijack. I think there might have been, I think it was 91 or perhaps before, but I'm pretty confident that in that decade before 9/11, there hadn't been any domestic hijacks, and NORAD was postured to intercept planes coming in from the coast.
Well, we're getting a lot of static on this line for some reason.
Are we? I don't know.
No, I'm not surprised. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We'll live with it or establish a new connection in a bit here. So keeping in mind, NORAD at that time, pre-9/11, was looking outward for threats, not at domestic air travel, not NORAD.
Exactly. That wasn't their job. And if you remember, before 9/11 and after the Cold War, NORAD was, to a certain extent, fighting for their existence. I mean, there was a lot of lobbying in Congress that you've got this expensive sort of dinosaur agency out in Cheyenne Mountain that's, you know, tracking Soviet bombers that don't exist anymore. I mean, they had their big PR campaign. They do this every year, which is tracking Santa Claus. They tried to sort of reposture themselves as an agency to assist with domestic threats such as drug runners coming into the country. So they did, from time to time, track drug runners. Of course, those were all coming over the borders and into the U.S. But that morning, they only had, and this is, again, changed, there were only 14 fighters on alert. There were two up in Otis. They were called. They, of course, did scramble. And you have to understand, there have been all these reports that came out and all these claims that, you know, there are hundreds of Air Force bases with fighter jets much closer. But the important fact to remember is you can't get a fighter jet in the air right away. It's not like going out to the garage and turning on your car.
No, we could only talk about the ones that were on alert.
It's getting out. Yeah, exactly. A fighter jet on alert is fueled. It's ready to go. It's armed. It's ready to fly.
Got it. So of those,
14 in the U.S., there were only, on the eastern seaboard within range of Washington and New York, there were only five. Officially, there had to be four on alert. There happened to be an extra one at Langley. There were three down there after we talked to the guys down at Langley.
That was not an unusually small amount at that time to be on alert?
No, that was what was required.
That
was always, it was the standard operating procedure before 9/11.
Okay.
And when you think about it in the pre-September 11th mindset, why would you have more on alert?
No,
there's what they would do is oftentimes during the Cold War intercept Soviet bombers. Those were from bases mostly up in Canada, but there was no need to have more, or there was no perceived need to have more than 14 planes.
All right, so who was actually scrambled? Who got where?
Well, what they did was Northeast Air Defense Sector. NORAD is divided into smaller segments, but Northeast Air Defense Sector, which is up in, I believe it's up in New York, upstate New York. Boston Air Traffic Control, Boston Center, called NEANS and said, we've got a problem, you guys should scramble flights. So they scrambled. But the problem is, standard operating procedure for NORAD, and this is still the case today, when you scramble a jet, the pilots are told to take off, and they're not given a location. They're told to get to the air.
Right.
They're vectored out to a holding pattern, usually offshore,
right,
to keep them outside of the domestic traffic patterns, because you remember that civilian airspace is extremely crowded. And, of course, air traffic control has sovereignty over civilian air traffic control has sovereignty over all of the civilian airspace. So they would be vectored usually offshore to kind of hang there and then told where to go. Now, at that point, they had had advance warning on one plane, and that was the plane that I believe it was the plane that hit the North Tower. New York Air Traffic Control finally spotted United Airlines Flight 175, which is the plane that hit the South Tower. By this point, I mixed that up slightly. And no, they were informed that Flight 11 was hijacked. You have to understand that as a civilian air traffic controller, having never had a situation like this before, it was very confusing. It was.
I heard there was a great deal of confusion.
Absolutely, because you're sitting there at your radar screen and you think the plane's crashed, and then you see that it's not crashed. You don't know what's going on.
I think the hijacker actually, they turned off the transponders, right? So that
exactly.
That they drop off the regular computer screens.
Yeah, the way air traffic control radar works, and this is something that's always glossed over, and it seems to this sort of Hollywood movie example, it's this very elegant radar system where you can just pinpoint what you're looking at, and the computer knows what it is.
Because they're actively transmitting.
That's how transponders work, exactly.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you the altitude, because remember, you're looking on a two-dimensional screen, so you'll see the altitude, you'll see where the flight's coming from, where it's going to, what flight number it is, what the airline is, and some other information. When you turn off the transponder, you have to rely on primary radar. And the way radar systems worked that day at most of the air traffic control systems is that you couldn't see primary radar returns, which is actually radar from bouncing out the plane and coming back
in
the paint. You couldn't see that on the same screen that you could see the transponders.
Understood.
So you'd have to switch screens, and that led to an enormous amount of confusion. And, of course, when you get out into over Ohio, and this was the issue later in the day, with Flight 77 and then Flight 93, the primary radar coverage isn't that good because the way the primary radar works is it's a stacked and sort of pancaked system. So you have certain air traffic control centers can see certain airspace, but they can't see below that. So the planes were not, nobody had thought that this would ever happen. It hadn't happened before. There hadn't been a case where a plane had lost transponder and radio contact. And so, to a certain extent, these guys were left to improvise and to find it as well as they could.
But they did call NORAD.
They did call NORAD
several times.
They did. And they called also for Flight 11. At one point, they thought it was going to Washington because they didn't know where it was headed. And then New York Center, which is New York Terminal Approach, New York Terminal Approach at JFK, actually called NEADS, and this is outside of the chain of command. This is completely outside of the chain of command. They were just picking up the phone and dialing the number.
Because there was really no precedent for this.
None
so
whatsoever.
Picking up the phone, a regular old phone, and calling NORAD and saying, hey, trouble here. Anyway, we've got to jump to it. What happened to the jets that were scrambled? How far did they get? How close did they get?
Well, what happened was they ended up out in a holding pattern over right over the Atlantic Ocean off of Long Island because nobody knew where these planes were. Because NORAD didn't have its own system of radar that could see effectively inside that air corridor, especially when you get into western New York. And So these planes are being held out there. They are, of course, under the if they're going to be vectored in after a flight, they're going to be vectored in by air traffic control because they're flying in one of the busiest air corridors in the country. So they're hanging out over the Atlantic Ocean. Air traffic control was scrambling to try to find these flights. They couldn't find the flights.
Did they ever get vectored?
Eventually. They were brought into New York City, and that was after the second tower was hit. And, of course, it happened in quick succession.
Right.
And it took a while for the news to filter back. I mean, this stuff. There is no command center here where everyone knew everything that was going on.
Understood. But the accusation that there was a stand-down order is ludicrous.
It is absolutely ludicrous. And besides, at that point, you also have to remember that these planes were flying under a rule of engagement, and this was sort of standing, and this goes way back to the Constitution, that the military can't police the civilians of the U.S. So,
right.
And these planes were under posse comitatus, and they couldn't fire on the jets that flew into the World Trade Center. That the only time those rules of engagement were changed was later in the day when President Bush had authorized NORAD to use lethal force against if there were more flights out there. Of course, that was way too late.
You know, Ben, of all these claims, the only one that I was ever tempted to believe could be true was the thing on Flight 93. I thought, you know, if it was shot down, hard as it might be, I would understand a presidential decision to do that at that point. So I didn't rule out the possibility that it could be shot down, that perhaps nothing was said about it. I thought, well, that one might be logical, but that's not what happened, is it?
No, it's not. And it's funny, I felt exactly the same way when we started working on this. And I had this suspicion that, like, you know, we went into this trying to find out if there was any truth, because that would have been the scoop of the century, if there had been truth in any of these.
That's a good point.
Yeah. That would have been, you know, what every journalist prays for. Would have been bigger than Woodward and Bernstein, of course. But we, going into the investigating Flight 93, I thought personally, and I think a bunch of us thought, there might be some truth there, because it does make sense. The order had been given. The authority was there. But as we started to really go through the evidence, and a lot of these claims that, for instance, there was a white jet in the area, that the debris field was 8 miles long, and there were human remains, you know, far away, you know, the way that you read it, because this was coming from news reports that came out that day, and the day after, when everyone was in a state of massive confusion, you read those, and there's no direction attached to it. There's no. It's tough to infer sort of where the plane was, where this debris was, and also it's just the very nature of the news cycle is that these reports that come out initially are going to be updated and revised as the news cycle goes on. I mean, it doesn't mean that the news is lying, but it means that the news is. Daily newspapers, I mean, they did an incredible Herculean effort reporting this stuff, but you know, the nature of the day was that they didn't have all the information all the time, and so as time goes on, this stuff gets revised and updated. Of course, those aren't cited in any of these conspiracy theories. Those are sort of forgotten about. But as we went into Flight 93, what we had to do first, and this is when the sort of everything fell into place, was make a map, figure out where the debris actually landed. One of the theories was that there's this piece of engine, and if you look at the news reports that came out around the time of September 11th and the days following, that there's this engine that was variously placed at 6 miles away, at a mile away, at, you know, 9,000 yards away. And the theory is that a heat-seeking missile had hit the engine, which knocked it off.
Yes,
knocks it off way down the flight path, and then the, you know, the plane goes for a while. And then
but the truth is, I guess, when a plane hits at 500 miles an hour, the engine with a lot of weight goes sailing, right?
Exactly, and that's not uncommon. When we talked to a whole bunch of crash investigators, and they've seen this happen before, they've actually seen an engine go much farther. In a case in Alaska. I mean, the point is, the NTSB investigators have nothing unusual here. The plane was coming in somewhere between 500 and 600 miles an hour, and it crashed in a space of 30 feet. And you've got the engine, which is extremely dense. One of the engines auged into the ground, the other rolled along down a hill into a catchment basin, and it's directly in line with where the flight is going.
Isn't there plenty of audio, or at least quite a bit of audio evidence, people on cell phones with relatives and others describing that the passengers were going to take control of this airplane? I mean, was that wrong?
No, that was absolutely true. I mean, there was plenty of audio evidence. People are making calls from the airphones. They have recordings of this. We've all heard them. You know, we've gone through the transcripts. And there is some confusion. It seems now to be the case that they didn't quite make it to the cockpit, that they were about to bust the cockpit door open, and then the hijackers themselves drove the plane in because they knew that they were going to get overwhelmed by passengers behind them.
Well, however it happened, though, there's nothing to take away from the heroic actions of those passengers, as we understand them. You didn't find anything in your investigation that takes away from that, did you?
No, none whatsoever. In fact, Flight 93 when we went through this, it was the one that at first we thought this is the one that's plausible and we're probably going to find something, and then it was also the section that just very quickly, the pieces all fell into place, and very quickly it was obvious that there was no jet that shot them down.
So you were actually approaching doing this story then with a pretty clear, open mind, in that you even thought the same thing I did about this flight, that it could have been shot down, and what a horrible decision it would have been, but a big story to uncover, to be sure, and you would have uncovered it and told that story if it really was that way.
Absolutely, and that's the case for the rest of the entire article. I mean, imagine if any of these were true. That would be huge.
It would be huge, yes, of course it would.
It's the scoop we all dream about as journalists.
All right.
The fact of the matter is they just weren't.
When we come back, we need to talk about melted steel. That's a central part of all this business, so, and you know, temperatures and all of that, all right?
Great.
Good. All right, hold it right there. From the high desert, my guest is Ben Chertoff from Popular Mechanics Magazine. They would indeed be the right people to go to the engineers, the stress guys, the people who construct buildings, scientists who can look at the evidence, video people and picture people who can see if that pod really was there. And when we come back, one of the central parts of what the conspiracy people are saying is that steel just could not have melted. It simply could not have melted, and it should have been standing after that jet fuel burn. When we come back.
Code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. You know, what I really should have done is done tonight just purely with Ben, and then tomorrow night taking calls for Ben, because it's going to be that big. I know that. We're never going to have time to get everything and get calls, too, but we're going to try, so stay put.
some of the conspiracy loonies really ought to have to read this the way they demand that we read their and watch their DVDs and so forth. Popular Mechanics. My guest is Ben Chertoff. Ben, we're going to have to hurry through some of this. We need a lot more hours, and even if I had them, we still wouldn't be even, believe me, with the number of hours devoted to the other side on Coast. Nevertheless, let's hit some high points. Jet fuel, not hot enough to melt steel. They make lots of noise about that one.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's everywhere, and that was on that full-page ad that we saw that really set this whole thing in motion. Well, it turns out that that's true. Jet fuel doesn't necessarily burn hot enough to melt steel, but the point is, steel doesn't need to melt to have a collapse like we saw on September 11th.
Oh?
Yeah. And if you actually get into the engineering of steel, you learn that it's a very interesting building material. We talked to numerous firefighters and engineers on this. One who was a deputy chief of the New York City Fire Department, and he mentioned to us, he actually wrote the book, Collapse of Burning Buildings.
Right.
He said he'd never seen melted steel in a building fire, at least right when they put the fire out, but what he had seen was a lot of twisted and warped steel. And the way steel works is, first of all, it is a very good conductor of heat, which is why you have fireproofing on tall buildings.
Of course, yes.
And, of course, the World Trade Center had spray-on fireproofing. And when steel gets hot, and what happened when the planes hit it was that, first of all, it knocked out a lot of the exterior facade, which was structural to that building, which is very unique to its construction, especially for that for the time it was built. And it took out some of the interior columns. What happens when the steel gets hot, that fireproofing is knocked off. You only need fireproofing knocked off in a small place for the heat to start to transfer to the entire beam. As steel gets hot, it doesn't melt, but what happens is, well, you get hot enough, it'll melt, but what happens in a fire is it expands on both ends, and it also softens. And the most important thing, and what was sort of
it bends.
Yeah, exactly. And it becomes softer, and it loses its structural integrity. And you've got to realize that these buildings are put together very carefully and very tightly so that when you've got structural components that are changing shape, that are expanding, it's going to do quite a bit to the structural integrity of the building itself. And but one of the most important takeaways from the whole thing is that the jet fuel didn't burn for that long. What happened was the planes went in, the jet fuel burned for about 10 minutes, and you had this very intense heat for 10 minutes, and that set everything else that was on those floors on fire. And so you've got that fire, and that burned for quite a while until the towers actually collapsed.
You mean like all the furniture and the
exactly, you've got furniture,
office, everything.
Exactly, furniture, computers, desks, carpets, drapes.
And that reached what kind of temperature?
Well, it probably reached around 1,800 degrees.
1,800. All right, so the steel then begins to bend, and then the floors start to pancake, and you have some engineering looks at that, right, on pancaking of floors and the stresses when one floor bangs down on the next?
Exactly. What happens is you have this massive heat, and it's going to soften, and it worked differently. We're lucky enough to work pretty closely with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and they had the luxury of almost 2 years and a lot of funding and time to go through and sort of pick up where the FEMA report left off. Many of these conspiracy theories cite the FEMA report as proof that there's a cover-up because it was so abbreviated and short, and they only worked on it for a limited amount of time. But what's important to remember is the FEMA report was a preliminary report, and the NIST investigation is huge, and they had a lot of time to go through this. And what they did was they built literally a replica of some of the office floors in the Trade Center.
Right.
And using computer modeling, they figured out where the fuel went when the planes hit. And so they were able to spray fuel into the building, into their model, at places that it would have gone in the actual buildings, and then they lit the whole thing on fire.
And the result?
What they found was that the steel weakened significantly, and they think that there were pockets of areas that were over 1,800 degrees, and at that point, steel has usually less than 10% of its structural strength.
Wow.
So what happened? I know it really did weaken it, It's a combination. What brought the towers down wasn't just the fire, and it wasn't just the impact of the planes, but it was a combination of the both. Because when the planes hit, there was spray on fireproofing that was knocked off, which let the steel become vulnerable to the heat. And it was also knocked out some of the structure of the building itself, so it didn't need as much heat to bring it down.
So no mainstream people you talk to at all went along with this planted explosives theory?
No, none whatsoever. We talked to, I mean, in terms of structural engineers and even explosives experts, we talked to, had to be at least 30 top structural engineers, those who had worked on the investigation and those completely independent of the investigation. We couldn't find one person who would believe that there were
not
in fact,
one.
Yeah, in fact, all the evidence points, there are oceans of evidence that point to the contrary.
And the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is it?
Yes.
Yes, very, very reputable group of scientists. In other words, they proved that's what brought the buildings down.
Yeah, that is. And, you know, they weren't even looking into it for the, I mean, the purpose of their investigation wasn't to say whether it was, you know, bombs or an airplane, but because from the outset, the evidence, even before you investigate it, is overwhelmingly on the side of what we saw happening that day. And they had the time, and they proved pretty conclusively what had happened.
What are the puffs of dust supposed to mean to these conspiracy theorists?
Well, that goes into the theory that there were explosives actually planted in the building.
Oh, yes.
And there are many different takes on this theory. The idea being that the plane flying in was sort of the cover, and then the explosives, these, you know, controlled demolition, I've heard them called squibs, were placed strategically throughout the building to ensure that they came down and also, you know, to make sure that it came down very neatly so that there wasn't damage to the surrounding areas, so that Wall Street wasn't wiped out. It gets very complex. And so as you watch the videos and the replays of the building's collapse, you can see as they start to collapse, there are areas where dust and debris is ejected forcibly outside of the building.
Yes.
Out of the windows.
Yes.
I mean, it literally are the windows breaking, and that has led to the idea that, you know, those are
explosions.
Demolition squibs. Those are controlled demolitions.
But in fact, they were what?
We have to realize that most of an office building, and the World Trade Center included, is air because you've got these massive open floor office spaces. So what happened is, as one floor is slamming down on the other, you've got this enormous overpressurization of the floor.
Of course.
So all this air has to go somewhere.
Blows
what
out
happened,
the windows.
Exactly. It blew out the windows. And that's what it is.
So you could, I suppose you could cite it as evidence of explosives, but in fact it was one floor collapsing upon the next, and of course it's going to create overpressure and blow out the windows, and that's what did it.
Exactly, exactly. It's really the simple answer that answers this question.
No plane debris at the Pentagon. Let's jump over there very quickly. This one I've heard I've had people challenge me. There's no plane, they say, that hit the Pentagon. This is ridiculous. There were no plane parts there. And then I usually ask the person, well, then, okay, what happened to that airplane and all those people? And they say, well, we don't know. Maybe it flew by and something else, a missile hit it or whatever. So deal with the Pentagon thing.
That's one of the most widespread theories.
Yes,
that came out in Thierry Masson's book, The Big Lie, which was actually a bestseller in France for a period of time. The no planes theory comes from this perceived lack of debris. And, of course, the World Trade Center was very well covered by the media. The Pentagon is a much more secure location. There are many fewer cameras there. You
of
can't
course.
Really get up close. And also just the nature of the crash. I mean, the planes that hit the World Trade Center were hitting into at that level, it's fairly thin steel. The Pentagon is made out of reinforced concrete. And when a plane hits it, a plane is very, very thin aluminum. And the plane isn't going to leave, a cartoon cutout of itself. There's not going to be a plane that's just sitting there intact. I mean, the thing was coming in upwards of 500 miles an hour and hit reinforced concrete. It literally disintegrated.
It also hit part of the ground first, apparently, right?
Exactly.
There's this big thing about the size of the hole in the Pentagon.
Right, the size was too small. What happened was one of the wings hit the ground and started to shear off. And then, of course, as the body of the plane went into the Pentagon, the wings, which are even lighter and filled with fluid, became almost a liquid-like state and flew in and had already sheared off at this point. So,
right.
So what you have is this very compact, what does, to a certain extent, resemble a missile. Of course, it's a passenger jet. That's what actually entered the Pentagon. And of course they did find the plane. It was halfway into the basement at the end, and it was compacted into about 20 feet. And there was also enormous amounts of small debris littering the lawn of the Pentagon.
Well, there were
photographs of that,
and not only photographs, but eyewitness testimony of people who said they were holding plane pieces in their hand.
Exactly.
And other evidence that some people were too, I don't know. I guess shocked to even film.
Yeah, it's a tragedy, and it's very gruesome. And talking to people who had been there, that really came out on the phone. That these people found body parts. They found the black box. There is just an enormous wealth of physical evidence that screams there was a Boeing that hit the Pentagon.
With all of that, why do they still maintain that it was some sort of missile and that this plane somehow mysteriously disappeared? And then I think there is another theory that all the people were shepherded who would have been on these planes into some other plane to be killed, American citizens. Isn't there something like that?
Yeah, it's called the bumble plane theory. We didn't so much get into that. The idea is that... There are different takes on this, that it was at Newburgh, that it was at Otis Air Force. There are all sorts of different Air Force bases that are cited, that there's a point where two of the flight paths cross each other. So the idea is that there they landed, they herded all the passengers onto Flight 93, and then Flight 93 was shot down to destroy that evidence, because there's this sort of perceived conspiracy about the lack of the planes being completely filled. Of course, that's a normal occurrence in airlines, but taken out of context, it's used as evidence that that this was all planned from beginning. Fit everyone on to Flight 93.
I hear you. The World Trade Center Building 7. Now, that one seemed strange to me at the time a little bit. I didn't understand the whole thing either. I mean, the two buildings came down, and then later another building came down that wasn't hit by an airplane. They make a big deal out of that, right?
Right, and that seems to be the one that at the end they'll say, well, okay, fine, all the other stuff, whatever, but you have to admit that the World Trade Center 7 was brought down with a controlled demolition. A lot of that stems from the FEMA report, because the Federal Emergency Management Agency didn't have much time to spend on World Trade Center 7, and they didn't do much investigating into it. Of course, National Institute of Standards and Technology is now working on that, and we were able to talk to their researchers about what they believe happened.
And?
Well, it turns out that the damage to the building facade, and they were able to piece this together from the evidence that was collected from Ground Zero. Of course, that is indeed another conspiracy in itself, that all the steel was shipped overseas immediately afterwards. Of course, most of the steel was. You had two buildings worth of steel, but a lot of it was collected as evidence. Small pieces of it. You don't need all the steel to make your to do your investigation. What happened was with World Trade Center 7, when the North Tower collapsed, an enormous amount of debris fell on the building itself and actually scooped out upwards of 25% of the south facade. I'm sorry?
I just said, my God, that's already documented visually at this point?
Well, there aren't many photos of the south facade, which is the problem, because that was below where the World Trade Center was, and most of lower Manhattan was uninhabitable. You just couldn't get down there at that point. But they were able to piece together that 25% of it was knocked out. And, of course, World Trade Center 7 itself was an unusual design. It had these massive open floors, so you had many, many thousands of square feet of office space, without load-bearing columns in between them. There were fewer columns carrying load. And so knocking out a couple of those really destabilized the entire building. And as you watch these videos of the building, you can see, and they were able to, NIST was able to chart exactly how the collapse happened. Some of the interior portions on the eastern south face of the building were knocked out. Of course, a fire raged in there for 7 hours. Most of it fed from a pressurized diesel line from the basement, which was not available to the FEMA investigators. They didn't know about
that. So that just fed the fire.
Exactly.
So hour after hour.
For 7 hours. And so you have one of the structural columns of the building on the east side breaks down, and you can actually see before it collapses, when you look at some of the photographs and the video footage, and this is what NIST did extensively, you can see that the penthouse drops away, and they disappear into the structure one after another. And then you see the building starting to fall from that east side of the structure. That falls first, and then that pulls down the west side of the structure.
Hmm. All right, good. Back to the Pentagon for a sec. A lot of people also said that there were a lot of the windows, unbelievably, incredibly, simply could not be intact. Those windows would have to be shattered, windows close to where, in fact, the plane entered the Pentagon. But there's a reason why those windows didn't shatter, right?
Absolutely.
What is it?
They were made not to shatter because they were blast-proof windows.
Remember, it's the Pentagon, folks.
And so what you have is this structural that you have reinforced concrete, and then these windows are made of blast-resistant glass, which they had installed, I believe it was the summer beforehand. We were able to talk to the guy who designed and installed these windows, and he said, all said and done, it was a tragic day, but he had to, say he was kind of happy his windows held up. And they were meant to withstand a blast like this, so they performed as they should. And, of course, not all the windows survived. Many of them broke, especially
right.
those immediately surrounding the crash.
Right. But a lot of them also survived. And the reason for that is because they were blast windows, for what it's worth out there, folks. All right, the F-16 pilot. Somebody supposedly, I guess Alex Jones, supposedly interviewed a pilot who claimed that he shot down, or that he knew somebody, I'm sorry, he interviewed somebody who said he knew somebody who shot down Flight 93. Is that correct?
That is. And, to Alex Jones's credit, he had a follow-up article on this, and he wasn't sure if this was true, but it got repeated all over the Internet. The first time it appeared was on the Alex Jones show. With this retired Army colonel who said that he had met the guy who shot down Flight 93. And then eventually it came out on letsroll911.org that they named the pilot, and they named him as Major Rick Gibney. And Rick Gibney is actually Lieutenant Colonel Rick Gibney, and he is...
Not a major at all.
Not a major, no.
Colonel. Okay.
He flies out of North Dakota, out of the 119th Air National Guard. And, of course... what is a National Guard pilot from North Dakota doing out in Pennsylvania shooting down Flight 93? Well, the 119th maintains a detachment at Langley, and those jets that were launched and scrambled that day actually were flying from the 119th. But we went back to the 119th and talked to them and talked to Lieutenant Gibney and talked to their press people there and went through their records, and it turns out, A, none of their planes got anywhere near Flight 93 because they were in a combat radius over air combat patrol over Washington.
Yes.
And Rick Gibney, that morning, Ed Jacoby, who was the then director of the New York State Emergency Management Office, was out in Bozeman, Montana for a meeting of emergency managers. He's the guy you need in New York because you've got an emergency going on, and it was his job to coordinate the relief effort at Ground Zero.
Ben?
Yep.
Hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour.
Good morning, Mr. Sunshine. You brighten up my day. Come sit beside me in your way. I
talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed so. My guest is Ben Chertoff. He's here explaining 9/11. From the point of view of a popular mechanics investigative article, a very serious one, who went to scientists and stress engineers and those kinds of people, about the claims made by conspiracy theorists about what brought down those buildings.
You don't...
Once again, Ben Chertoff from Popular Mechanics. Ben, the obvious thing to do would be to go to the lieutenant colonel and ask him if he shot down the plane, right?
Exactly.
Well?
Exactly. So that's what we did, and the answer was absolutely not. Nobody from the 119th got anywhere near Flight 93. What happened was Rick Gibney flew out to Bozeman, Montana, where Ed Jacoby was. He flew out in a modified two-seat F-16B. Landed out in Bozeman. They gave Mr. Jacoby a quick brush up on how to use the ejection seat, gave him a flight suit and a spare helmet, and after some about an hour of instruction, they both hopped in the F-16 and then flew cross country and landed in New York so that he could come and run the relief effort at the World Trade Center site.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't anywhere near Flight 93.
Look, we could go on and on and on and on, but we don't have the time. I want to discuss a little bit the people that are making these claims.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, in the course of doing this story, when it became known that you were doing this story, I'm sure, I mean, I read some emails at the beginning of the program, just a little tiny sample of what's been sent to me. These are really rabid folks, and they call names very serious, bad names, you know, like traitor. They use names like that, and I wonder if in the course of this investigation, or even after the article came out, you have suffered the same sort of thing.
I'll tell you, most of it has been after the article came out. We're pretty overwhelmed by the response. In fact, before it even hit the stands, we were getting only a couple of issues had gone out to subscribers. We were getting, and the internet traffic was pretty intense. They were debunking the Popular Mechanics story, and we also got at one point, I think it was about an email a minute, and we've gotten well over 500, probably closer to 1,000 emails. And it's, to everyone who did write an email, we are going to try to respond to them. But the problem is we just have so many. We're trying to work through them.
How many of them were like the stuff that I was reading?
I would say in the initial blast of emails, and this is before the story was out, and I think this is before many people had actually read it, most of them were pretty negative and pretty mean. And the irony was a lot of them threw back the same stuff that we had just gone through and debunked. I mean, we get these emails from people who would say, well, you know, what about jet fuel? It doesn't burn hot enough to melt steel. And you'd sit and kind of slap yourself.
Been covered, hey.
Yeah, and say, well, I guess you guys didn't read it yet.
Okay.
Some of it was a knee-jerk response. Others were long, in-depth letters saying, well, okay, you guys answered these 16 claims. Well, what about, you know, these 52 other...
All right, have there been any other significant claims made since the article that ought to be addressed?
We were actually thinking of doing a follow-up to this because a lot of the emails and letters and websites and responses said, well, you didn't address so-and-so. And, the point of our article wasn't to retell the story of 9/11. It wasn't to tell the whole story at all.
Right.
The point was to take what we saw as the claims that were getting repeated the most and to put them up to what they wanted, which was serious, mainstream media attention and actually, an actual investigation into it. So that's what we did. There are new claims coming in every day, and we are thinking of doing a follow-up where I'm not sure if we are going to be able to do that. I think it'd be a lot of fun to do that and look at some more. But I'll tell you, going through 16 of these and having all of them fall apart pretty quickly and turn out to be false, it
sure
says something about probably what the rest of them are going to be.
What about the vitriolic nature of these, so many of these people involved in this? I mean, it's beyond the pale. I mean, what a lot of them are saying is just beyond the pale. It's incredible to me. I've never quite seen anything like it. They're so wrapped up in this. And I guess they believe that their own government really would do this to them. I think it's an amazing thing. I really do. And I'm not naive, and I don't think our government's perfect, and they've probably done some nasty stuff in the past, but, I mean, on this scale, no, I don't think so. And it's very vitriolic. You have any thoughts on why it's so intense?
I don't know necessarily why it's so intense, and it is so angry. I mean, there's just this massive hatred of,
yes,
of the government. And what I found fascinating, though, is that it was from not only we got picked up by a couple of blogs when this came out, Independent linked to us, and a lot of the sort of right-wing blogosphere, so to speak, made the point that this is the loony left, that was making all these claims. And when you actually look at it and you see who's making them, it is, very loud on the sort of far, far left wing of the political spectrum, but also on the far right wing.
Isn't that interesting?
It's wild, and there's this point at which they sort of back each other up, and they have different. They both have this agenda of absolute hatred for either the government or the administration or all administrations, and sort of any way, the way I feel or the way that we've kind of come to the conclusion that any way to badmouth this administration is okay, because I think to a certain extent the mindset is, well, the government lies to us, so it's okay to lie about them. And, everyone has a right to be angry about 9/11. It was an absolutely tragic day, and there's no doubt that mistakes were made and that there's a lot of work to be done to make sure that that doesn't happen again. Everyone has a right to be mad about it, and everyone has a right to ask questions. But in so doing, everyone also has a responsibility to to have a respect for the truth and to make the right questions and to not make this echo chamber of what are sometimes misrepresentations and sometimes outright lies.
I bet you got an awful lot of emails saying you had sold out, you were part of the government official line, and that's all you are is a government mouthpiece, right?
We have been claimed, we are on the Pentagon payroll. We're apparently, they say that we're on the CIA payroll, we are just a mouthpiece for the administration. And the thing was, our story was very apolitical. I mean, we didn't look at this from a political standpoint. We just went into the actual physical claim.
The hardware part of it, yeah.
Exactly, which is really our expertise. We don't need or want to get into the politics behind it, because that's not really what this is about. This is about the actual physical evidence that a lot of these sites were citing. And what's also fascinating is David Korn, who's a writer for The Nation. Amidst all this, we had this great response from sort of centrist right wing of the political spectrum and the centrist left wing of the political spectrum. David Korn, who writes for The Nation, has also apparently been called a CIA plant,
mm-hmm,
by some of the 9/11 skeptics movement. And so he wrote a nice piece about how, now Popular Mechanics and David Korn is represented as part of the CIA. And to a certain extent, these theories are counterproductive for actually getting to the meat of what went wrong that day. Because they distract everyone's attention, and it's this massive outpouring of energy, and it's misdirected.
What was the craziest theory that you found out there?
Oh, The Bumble Planes one was one of the weirder ones, that the planes were that the planes were switched, and that there was this that one of them was all the planes landed in one spot, and then they loaded all the passengers onto Flight 93 and shot it down. Another one was that the World Trade Center was emitting a radio beacon, and that in downtown New York there were radio and power outages that morning because of this radio beacon that was homing in these planes. That there were no passengers aboard the planes at all.
Homing in the planes.
Planes were completely remote controlled, which, you know, it speaks to a certain naivete about how airplanes work to a certain extent, that people look and they say, well, Global Hawk, the technology of Global Hawk, the unmanned drone, they can make a Global Hawk fly. Why couldn't they just slap that technology into what looks like a Boeing 767, have no passengers on board at all, and fly that in, fill it with explosives or what have you. There are levels of inherent complicity from everybody in the government. I mean, to make these plans work, you'd have to have thousands and thousands of people in on it.
Yeah, I'll say.
And that's just ludicrous.
I know. Do you have any hope whatsoever? I mean, the article is now published. Mm-hmm. Do you think that in your lifetime or my lifetime or anybody who's listening right now, lifetimes, that this will be, the facts will finally be accepted as the real way it happened? Or do you think this will go on forever, or at least until we wipe ourselves off the face of the globe?
You know, I don't know. That's a very good question. To a certain extent, it's getting louder. All this, ballyhoo about there being an inside job here. But
yes.
I think in the mainstream, when you talk to people who actually were there, who have firsthand knowledge, I mean, that was our strategy for reporting this, was to get as close to firsthand knowledge as we possibly could. I mean, there's not even a second thought that there's any possibility that these theories could be true. I think it would take a much better effort and much better evidence and some real truth, which just isn't there, to throw this really into the mainstream, even though it is sort of trickling in there. If you're going to, it's fine to be angry about this, but to continue to repeat things that are just plain wrong, that you ignore because of your own politics, you're not really serving your own cause. And I think that's, I just can't see it continuing forever like that.
Huh. Well, I wish I could agree with you, but looking at other things that perhaps are near this magnitude, assassinations and other things. The moon.
That one's still there, isn't
lots
it?
Lots of people who don't think we ever went to the moon. Let me go to the phones. I really do want to let the audience ask their questions. I think it's important, so let's do it. First time caller line, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Hello?
Hi. You're
Hi,
on the
how
air
you
with,
doing?
With Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Hi. I want to ask him the question. He had alluded to how all the people were supposedly crowded into the one plane and that their cell phone conversations were voiced over. I want to know the technical complexity of that, because these were not famous people. They were anonymous people, and the time frame that it would take to be able to do that.
Well, no, wait a minute. Ben has not said that's what happened, sir.
No, he didn't say it. He had just talked about one of the crazy theories out there.
That's one of them.
Right. And I was just wondering how technically, from a technical standpoint of view, would it be to get somebody's voice on a cell phone and then splice together a conversation with their loved ones to convince their loved ones that this was the actual person.
Sir, is that what you believe happened?
No, I don't.
You don't. So you
I just want him to debunk that theory by saying.
I see. All right. Mm-hmm. Ben?
Well, I'll tell you, we didn't look into that. I actually haven't really heard that one specifically, but I imagine it would take, A, a lot of people to do that, and B, you'd have to somehow get the recordings beforehand,
mm-hmm.
So that you have some sort of baseline comparison. And then, to get that done that day, transmitted as it's going on, because of course these calls happen real time, would take a pretty Herculean effort, and it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do a pretty good job of splicing together somebody's voice and making a conversation, but you can always tell when it's faked, and especially a loved one. I mean,
right.
that would be really tough.
Right.
All right, sir.
That's it. Thank you for having the show.
You're very welcome. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Hey, how are you gentlemen doing?
All right, sir. Welcome.
Mark from Henderson, Nevada. I think.
Yes, Mark.
I read the piece that Mr. Chertoff wrote, and I want to say, first, I didn't really see any empirical evidence that would disprove that the government was complicit in 9/11. And one thing about the methodology that I noticed is it's like you take these particular theories that people have, take, for example, the no planes theory at the Pentagon and try to deconstruct that. And the fact of the matter is you can prove that a plane flew into the Pentagon, but that still does not disprove that the government was complicit in 9/11.
That's right. You're absolutely right. It doesn't. All right. But you do acknowledge, unlike most, that a plane did fly into it?
I don't know.
I don't know. Well, then what about the pieces of the plane, the burning bodies, the whole thing? Eyewitnesses. What about all that?
To be honest, I mean, you look at the record of this government. I don't think we can believe anything.
You're not answering my question. Don't talk about the record of the government. Talk about the pieces of the plane, sir. Eyewitnesses and the burning bodies and all that. Eyewitnesses to all of that.
I haven't seen any of that. This is the most surveilled corridor in the world, and all they have is a little Logitech webcam shot of the Pentagon. Why don't they show us the video footage? I'm sure they would have some sort of video footage.
All right, Ben, that's a good question. Why there has been some sort of refusal? Is there video footage that exists that's being held from us?
Well, I'll tell you, we didn't investigate that completely. In fact, we didn't really work on that at all. We might think about doing that in a follow-up article, and it's certainly something we'll...
Okay, so that would be on the list.
Yeah, probably it would be, because that one seems to be out there quite a bit. I'll tell you, a lot of the information about what hit the Pentagon, in fact, all of this stuff, because it's a criminal investigation, and this is standard procedure with just about any time there's a criminal action in terms of a transportation accident, the FBI takes over. And the FBI, and having dealt with other cases and in completely separate incidents, reporting during a criminal investigation, they are very reluctant to release anything because this is their case, and they want to be able to go and prosecute and have a clean case. They don't want the media attention that's going to, the sort of the media making their own conclusions and people making their own conclusions themselves after reading the media. So it's very tough, and the government has been criticized quite a bit for not releasing enough information. This was a very big incident. I think that might be, personally, I think it would be nice if we could get these, if there is video, if we could see it. But to be perfectly honest, that's pretty much standard operating procedure. And beyond that, there is there's just mountains of evidence to prove that a plane did hit the Pentagon, and there's very little, in fact, nothing that I've seen to say anything to the contrary, in terms of empirical evidence.
Do you feel that these 9/11 conspiratorial people might be able to make finally enough noise that the government would politically be forced, would have their hand forced, into releasing some of what they have not yet?
Maybe. I think they'd have to convince a lot of the sort of less prone to believing these conspiracy theories. They'd have to come up with a lot more and probably better arguments, since a lot of these really do fall through. But I don't think we will even need to, because in all likelihood, these trials are probably going to be over, in the next couple of years, and this stuff will come out in the process of doing that.
What about those who say that there weren't any hijackers on the planes, and they feel there's evidence indicating they weren't even there, and that they're still out there alive somewhere today? You've heard that?
Yeah, we also didn't look into that too much because that just seems so implausible from the very start. That came out, there was a BBC report that came out soon thereafter, and the BBC report, of course, didn't say that they were alive, it said that, that people had reported.
Yeah, but somehow it's become that.
Yeah, and it's sort of the echo chamber of this.
Ben, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Ben Chertoff is my guest from the high desert in the middle of the night. I'm Art Bell.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. Ben Chertoff is here from Popular Mechanics Magazine, which did an in-depth examination of 16 of the most prevalent claims of the conspiracy people about 9/11, the inside job people, and dealt with them scientifically. I'm not sure it matters to a lot of people, but they did. You can either read the article yourself or look into it yourself, but there's been a very great deal of research done. Now, that may not matter to a lot of people, like Frank in Tampa, Florida, whose message I'll have for you in a moment. Are you... We're just never going to get to it all. But, Ben, there were some claims made, I think it was on the Alex Jones site, that showed a seismic print of what he claimed would show explosives were going off in the buildings, right? And I think that you put up the entire graph, which proved that that was not the case. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite ones.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it was you just... It's the kind of thing where you, when you actually talk to people who made these seismic observations and actually look into what it means, you see that the graph that is repeated over and over again on these sites is this very compressed, very long in terms of time frame graph. So you've got one line that equals a half an hour. And so it looks like there's this massive spike. And I guess the what one of the theories that pulls out of that is that there was this massive expenditure of energy and ground shaking before the towers collapsed, which supposedly bolsters the idea that there were explosives.
Explosives, yeah.
So actually some, in fact it was, I believe, Christopher Bolin, who was the same gentleman who had...
that article.
Yeah, spent some time calling my mother, is he had also called the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, who had recorded this stuff. So we went back to Lamont-Doherty, and we found out that the interpretations that have been repeated throughout the conspiracy sites were actually categorically wrong. That the when you look at the graph spread out over a smaller time period, so you can actually see what's going on. When you look at it magnified under 1 minute or 30 seconds, for instance, as we show, you can see that there are no large spikes at the beginning, and that, in fact, the bulk of the energy is transmitted when it should be from what we saw on television, when the debris actually hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, the very energy waves that the Palisades Observatory recorded are exactly what you wouldn't see if there were explosives, that explosives actually have a completely different seismic print when they go off.
Well, shouldn't these people like Alex have to respond to this now?
You would think, and that's, as journalists, it's kind of our job to report what we see, but I think a lot of these sites come in to the come into the reporting of this stuff, and those who actually do go through at least some legwork of picking up a phone, which seems to be pretty rare, they come into it and they ask their questions with their minds already made up, and it's a lot of picking and choosing what sort of evidence you're going to put up, ignoring a massive ocean of evidence to the contrary.
Well, that's why I asked you about how long this is going to go on. I think forever. Frank in Tampa says, what liars you both are. Shame on you. As you're both agents for the murders. Agents for the murders, he calls us. You have lost your credibility, Art, and your guest doesn't have any. Liars. That's just what you are. Liars, 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 liars. Nine times he says liars, and that's the message. These minds, if you wish to call them that, are not going to change.
It's amazing, the liar argument. I mean, are they calling everyone we spoke to liars?
I guess.
We couldn't find one person who gave any of these theories any thought whatsoever. I mean, it's just categorically the opposite. I mean, are they all liars?
First time caller line, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hello.
Hi, Art. I was just I just sent you an email in regard to two pictures from United Airlines. These pictures, I'm a pilot, by the way. I've been flying for 11 years, and I've taken these pictures at about 38,000 feet, and these aircraft passed over me about 1,000 feet above me. And I snapped two pictures. Actually, I snapped a few more. But just to kind of get the picture and show you what it looks like, the two stripes that people claim that they were missiles and these aircrafts were carrying missiles, I mean, it clearly shows that they were not missiles. You could clearly see the paint themes on these aircrafts. United always paints their aircraft like that, and the reason to that is because underneath the aircraft, we have usually antennas that are VHF and UHF, and I'm sure you're aware of that. And those antennas cannot be painted.
Caller, why do you think these people want us to believe there were humps and bumps and bombs and missiles when the real story fits?
It's an interesting world, and you know what? I'll tell you this. This is the only country where you could believe in things like that. If it was in a different country, believe me, especially in the Middle East, you wouldn't be able to speak your mind like this. But this is what makes this country so great, is that there's, freedom of speech.
Well, you're right about that.
And I don't, I laugh at these stories. It's just such a joke. You see all these conspiracies. Another reason to that is, I see some of these websites. Obviously, and people have written books about these. It's all about money. People are making money out of this.
Is that. People are selling books, magazines, and to be fair, Popular Mechanics in this case. But there's profiteering going on over this, isn't there, Ben?
I believe there is, and certainly Thierry Masson made, I'm sure, I don't know offhand, but I'm sure he made quite a bit selling that book in France, and there are DVDs being sold, and there is, to a certain extent, a business going on. But I think your caller really makes a really good point about our investigation of this, especially. You have on these conspiracy sites all these sort of armchair pilots who overnight, learn everything they possibly can about an airplane from the World Wide Web, which, of course, is
is unreliable at best. And then, but when you actually talk to the people who fly these planes, you actually talk to the people who build these buildings.
Right.
I mean, it's just categorically false. All these theories, and they just don't give it any thought. And it really speaks to sort of the level of to a certain extent, it's just like these naive views about how the planes and the government work.
A lot of this is politically motivated, isn't it? In other words, a lot of the people getting behind this are Bush haters.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. There is sort of a feeling of it doesn't matter whether what I say is true as long as it's bad for the administration or bad for the government in general. I mean, I think some of this goes beyond just Bush. You know, that is okay. I think that's one of the reasons you see people repeating claims that are just patently untrue is because there's a political motivation behind it as opposed to a motivation to actually learn the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly found that very quickly.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Oh, you're going to have to yell at us, hon.
Oh, I'm sorry. My son was at the military base here in Florida when they got a call from the from the White House. That plane in Pennsylvania, they had an order to shoot it down, but I think it went down before they could do this because he was right on the phone with me, and I immediately called Fox News.
Well, I sure wouldn't doubt that, ma'am.
That is the truth. There was an order out there, and they were setting up a combat radius.
And there's something here, too, about you. You were talking about your connection with Michael Chertoff.
Yeah.
This came from the mailbag, and it said, the shirt part of his name means devil. My Russian dictionary also adds spirit of evil to the definition. This man's name means of the devil, shirt, devil, OFF, of the... And somebody just sent me this yesterday.
You hear that, Ben? Of Chertoff, of the devil?
That's very funny.
That's a Russian dictionary.
My dad has said that, too. Apparently, there are a couple of different interpretations of it because as a Russian word, it's not, there's some sort of grammatical problem with it as a word. So there's all sorts of different theories in my family about how the name came about, whether it actually means little devil or not. But it's. You know, you want to build a conspiracy out of that,
Welcome to it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Hi, I really feel privileged to be able to speak on the radio tonight. I want to ask about the PBS documentary that was shown on 9/11 in plain sight, where Mr. Silverstein, who is the owner of the Twin Towers, said that he had on Building Number 7 pulled, which is parlance for set with charges and explosives and demolished, on the very day of 9/11, less than 8 hours after the attacks occurred. Now, doesn't it take days or even weeks to set charges? So that would say to me that this has been planned for a long time in advance.
Ben?
Well, actually, to set up a controlled demolition, it can take, especially for buildings that size, it takes years sometimes. Then they have to pull out all the support structures inside. They essentially clean out the office. You got to run wiring over the entire thing. You can't do it wirelessly because there's just too many signals to these charges. But I'm glad somebody brought up the Larry Silverstein comment because we certainly looked at that, and that's a pretty simple one. If you watch the documentary again, what he says is they decided to pull, which is referring to the fire department. And, of course, in some circles of the controlled demolition industry, pull is used to mean that you actually demolish a building.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, talk to any firefighter. Walk down the block, talk to a firefighter, ask them what it means when you're in a building and you pull. There are two things, and we did this, of course. There are two things pull means to a firefighter. It means you can pull hoses out of a truck,
mm-hmm.
or it means you evacuate a building
mm-hmm.
because it's probably going to collapse because it's dangerous. So when they made the decision to pull, they literally made the decision to leave the building, which they did.
So they were saying, get out, she's not structurally stable, and they're going to go.
Exactly.
So that's what they meant by pull.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple explanation, and it's the one that's true.
All right, Ben. There were a number of statements made by structural engineers and some others that were misused by the conspiracy folks, weren't there, to the point
absolutely.
Where some of these people felt like they've had their lives ruined?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you're talking about specifically, and this is the one that made it into press, and this certainly wasn't the only instance we found of this,
right.
was a man named Van Romero, who works out in at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. He was interviewed by the Albuquerque Journal. I believe it was on 9/11 itself. He was interviewed, and he had. It was printed that he said, "quote there were some explosive devices inside the buildings that caused its collapse," and that he said that essentially that the collapse of the structures resembled those of controlled implosions.
Resembled those of controlled,
exactly,
yes,
old structures. Well, soon we talked to Van Romero at length, and he mentioned to us that soon after that hit the stands, he realized that wasn't exactly what he said. And what he had said that day, and this is just from watching it on television, he wasn't there. He was halfway across the country. What he said was, it looked like controlled demolition.
Which is exactly what you told me earlier in the program about the puffs of dust, right?
Exactly. I mean, you can look at that and say, well, yeah, it kind of looks like explosions. Of course, they're a lot bigger than what you would see in a controlled demolition because you want the explosive force going into the building and not out the windows. What happened with Van Romero is he called up the paper and he asked for a retraction, and he got one. It was printed, I believe it was a week or two later. Of course, many of the sites just put the initial article up.
Not the retraction.
They don't print the retraction.
That's normal.
Some, this is what was even more fascinating, and Mr. Romero went into this with us. Some sites actually claimed that he had been gotten to, the powers that be
got to him.
Yeah, exactly, and told him to change his story. But of course he said to us, you know, he has no doubt, absolutely no doubt that the Trade Center and World Trade Center 7 fell because of sort of the mainstream view that it was damaged from the planes and from the fires. And he absolutely doesn't think for a second that there were any controlled shake charges in the buildings.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Yeah, hi, guys. Great show. I'm just wondering, how do you get in a plane, a full-size airliner, to go through a 16-foot hole in a Pentagon without clipping a wing or dragging an engine into the surrounding lawns or knocking over lamp standers on the highway? It seems that the plane evaporated and there were no wing damage or tail segments or luggage or seating or anything visible, including on that website, letsroll911.org. It's very, very informative. I was just wondering what you had to say about that.
First of all, the 16-foot hole that's quoted all over, and it was also quoted in Pierre Nissan's.
Yeah, before the roof collapsed.
Right. The only 16-foot hole was on Ring C, and that was an exit hole from the landing gear, according to Mehta Sozen, who had studied this with ASCII, who did the building performance report. And there was the problem, and I think the reason why the speculation was kind of able to run out of control like it has, is because there aren't that many pictures available before.
How do you get level wings that level, that close to the ground, without dragging a cowling or an engine or a portion of that aircraft right through that whole lawn section?
And well, there were. And they,
leaving fuel burning. There's no fuel burns on that lawn except for about the first 25 feet from the building.
Right. Well, you have to realize that this stuff is moving at 580 miles an hour.
Yeah, but it's compressing against the wall of the building.
Right. So what happens is it goes into the building, and they've done computer simulations of this at length, and you can see exactly where the fuel goes. And it enters the building in a liquid state. There were skid and burn marks on the lawn, and by the time most of the pictures were out, the section of the Pentagon in question had already collapsed.
Jamie McIntyre for CNN was right there live stating there was no significant wreckage of any sizable aircraft.
Right, there wasn't, which is
how's that?
What you would expect when a plane is very thin aluminum and the thing was going extremely quickly and it's hitting reinforced concrete. The energy involved is enormous.
What about the lamp standards given the altitude of the structure, the first floor being the major impact site? The lamp standers on the highway, not more than, say, 40 yards from the building. How do you get a plane to do a left turn nose in into a building?
To be perfectly honest, we didn't deal with the lamp stands. That's something that we might look at.
Seems like that's the way you're doing the whole show here. You're not dealing with a lot of connecting dots here.
Well, our purpose in doing this, and I think I've said this before, but our purpose was not to tell the complete story. And what we did was we took what was repeated often. The lampstand one I've seen now since, but it's not one that's repeated very often. And I'll tell you that the highway is actually many hundreds of yards away from the Pentagon. And when the plane, when the plane flew in, it didn't just hit the first story, of course. It hit the first, second, and I believe part of the third story. And that was all documented from evidence that they recovered soon thereafter.
So that's another one that if you were to do a follow-up might be worthy of exploration?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I don't have in front of me what the flight path of the plane was, so I can't say.
Is it believed that it hit about 25 feet in front of the impact of the building? Is that about where it hit?
Yeah, part of the plane, part of the fuselage and part of the wing. And, of course, when you've got a piece of very fragile aluminum moving at that speed, like an airplane, it breaks up. I mean, it literally shreds. And you see this in many other plane crashes. I mean, it's not just the plane crash at the Pentagon. I mean, remember ValueJet that went down in Florida? I mean, that,
yes.
There's almost nothing left. And think of Flight 93 in Shanksville. I mean, there's a perfect example. The thing buried itself, over 30 feet underground, and all that was left, and there was a massive explosion when it hit the ground, were these tiny scraps of metal, because the energy involved is enormous. I mean, it's many tons. It's equal to the energy of a plane hitting something solid is equal to many tons of TNT. And it's something that, I mean, I think there's a very Hollywood interpretation of what a plane crash is going to look like, because it's not something that we see every day, thank God.
Thank God indeed. All right, we are at the bottom of the hour, Ben, so hold tight. We've got another 30 minutes to go. Ben Chertoff is my guest from Popular Mechanics Magazine, which took 16 of the most popular, prominent conspiratorial views and went to the scientists and the structural engineers and checked them out. And they simply didn't check out. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed. Good morning, everybody. From Popular Mechanics, Ben Chertoff is here. And we'll get to as many of you as we can. Stand by. God. Ben, I think that somebody calling himself Big Wave Dave from Portland, Maine, has come up with one that's going to put you right back where you belong.
Great.
He says, Art, conspiracy proven. Under Windows 95 Word program, set font to Windings, plug in QNY22, the tail of Flight 11, and see what symbols you see. This program was made in 1995. Have you seen that?
I have. I love those. I mean, that's like one of the ones that came out right afterwards. I mean,
I know.
I mean, there's no, obviously there's no conspiracy there, but it's really funny. And of course, that doesn't work if you actually try it. I don't think it works. I haven't tried it.
Well, then somebody else here says, look, great program, but sorry, I like conspiracies too much. Maybe there's some truth in that. You know,
well, they're fun. You know, I love reading around this stuff, but I mean, this is 9/11 stuff.
Yeah, this is 9/11. This isn't fun.
And yeah, and these are, I mean, these are not your normal conspiracies. I mean, this is just too much, and there's too much evidence to the contrary to really make these work.
Oh, that's right. First time caller line. Your turn with Ben Chertoff. Hello.
Hi there, Art. I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening to you for, I don't know, probably going on like 9 years now. Yeah. So I was compelled to call tonight because I really have to take issue with your guest and how he accuses others of sloppy journalism.
Okay.
When
all right, well, be specific.
Well, first of all, the NTSB, according to them, none of the four crashes were given a normal investigation. Jurisdiction was handed over to the FBI. So when he says the NTSB didn't find anything, he's not lying. He's, you know, saying a mistruth. And that's what a lot of what I noticed with your guest is a lot of it, he's not lying. He's not directly doing anything wrong. He's just brushing off and skipping over a lot of things. I mean,
right, so
why were there only...
All right, hold it. Let's get this straight. You're saying the NTSB was bypassed and the FBI took over the investigation, so of course the NTSB didn't find anything. Is that what you just said?
Well, supposedly, normally when that happens, and that's never happened, but normally when that happens, if jurisdiction is needed to be given over to the FBI, then the NTSB is still supposed to be involved, and they weren't involved.
Okay, Ben?
So that's why they didn't find anything.
Well, hold on now. Ben?
Well, first of all, I'm not exactly sure where you're referring to our NTSB findings. I mean, it was probably over in the Flight 93 stuff, and they were on scene for quite a while going through the wreckage.
Yes.
And it is standard operating procedure when there is a criminal act having to do with our transportation system that the FBI will claim jurisdiction over that and will control it. I mean, they will work with the NTSB, but the FBI is in control. Now, we were able to talk to some of the NTSB guys who were on scene and able to tell us what they found there. But, I mean, I don't know if you remember the train crash. This is a great example out. It's a tragic example, but it's also a good example. Out in California, a couple of months ago, the guy who had driven his car...
Of course.
Onto the train tracks to commit suicide and then had second thoughts.
Yeah.
That investigation was immediately handed over to the FBI because it was a criminal investigation. And, I mean, that's just how it works. You know, there's nothing fishy going on, but unfortunately, for people who are convinced that there's something not true out there and require all the evidence, and I really think for some of these diehard conspiracy theories, it doesn't matter how much evidence you show them.
That's kind of what I've been telling you all night, really.
Yeah, I mean,
in a lot of ways.
The conspiracy is still going to be there, but, you know, the FBI just doesn't release everything right away, and you have to wait till the trial's over for it to happen. I mean, even the NTSB is like that, and I worked with them on a number of different stories. It takes a while for them to come out and say exactly what they found because they're still conducting their investigation.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Art. Thank you. Kudos to your guest, and Art, thank you for bringing some intellectual sensibility back to the airwaves. I am so happy to hear your guest tonight. I listen to the talk radio a lot, from one end of the dial to the other, and it doesn't take long for a person to realize that your guest is totally right when it comes to the extreme left and the extreme right coming at this conspiracy theory. Let me tell you, this is my opinion, Art, and I don't mean to personally put anybody down, but I have to say that where Alex Jones is coming from, it to me is an anti-Semitic viewpoint. The conspiracy theorists, it doesn't take you long to listen to their rhetoric that they blame the Jews for every world problem that's wrong in this world. And when you've got people like that, it's just, it's, in my opinion, it's horrible. And from the extreme left, you've got Michael Moore sitting in the DNC convention in the guest of honor box next to Jimmy Carter, spewing the same rhetoric. And unfortunately now, Howard Dean at the head of the DNC. Art, these are both groups that hate Bush. One hates the government. One has the likeness of, in my opinion, of the Matthew Hales of this world, and the other ones, I would be embarrassed if I was a Democrat, and all I can say is kudos. I have watched every kind of thing that you can watch on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel. The plane that went into the Pentagon banked to the left, lost his left wing, going 500 miles an hour.
Right.
It doesn't take a stupid person to understand or a smart person to understand that that thing went in like a bullet. And where in the H-E-L-L is Barbara Olson? Is she just floating out there somewhere? I mean, these people are crazy, Art.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you, and have a good night. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Hi.
Hello, Ben. This is Travis from Richmond, Kentucky. And I agree with you 100% on talking about the planes, how they hit the World Towers and the Pentagon. I don't think that's really an important issue from the standpoint of what is the crime.
Well, it's only important, sir, because so many of these conspiracy guys are saying it didn't happen.
Well, I know, but I have some other questions that,
well, go ahead.
Aren't answered by either side of that.
That's fine. That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. My angle is starts with the before 9/11 knowledge, who had knowledge, and so on and so forth. We'll start with Willie Brown, mayor of San Francisco, got a phone call the day before. I heard him say that at the pulpit, University Cathedral in Los Angeles, with Dr. Dean Scott in November of 2003.
Dr. Scott. Rest his soul. Now, this phone call said what? What? All this was going
to
happen?
Willie Brown got a phone call that said, don't fly to New York.
Don't fly to New York.
Right.
Okay.
And now I've read some other articles that said that there were a couple of officials that canceled their flights also on the 10th. The Attorney General began flying non-commercial, several weeks before 9/11.
All right, let's deal with all of that. Were there any important evidences that you uncovered anywhere along the line, Ben, that people had warning that this was going to happen, indicating a prior knowledge?
Well, I'll tell you, this is outside of the scope of what we worked on, specifically on this article. But, I think you'll see, especially, and I think the story of September 11th will probably be one, at least in the government, and the lead-up to it as a total breakdown in security. And it does look like there were certainly the clues there, from what I've read, and this is not speaking to the story we did or our investigation, because this is really quite far outside of that scope. We really stuck to the physical claims. But I think what we've seen in both the 9/11 report and what's come out in the papers and the news and the sort of Richard Clark reports is that there were at least the clues there and the warnings, and I think what you take away from it is that before September 11th there was a major communication breakdown in the federal government. Now whether people actually had foreknowledge that it was going to happen on that day, I can't say yes or no, because I haven't.
I remember some stories almost immediately after the event, indicating that there had been some stocks dumped. There was a big dump that went on, and that story was short-lived, really. It sort of went away. You have anything on that at all?
Yeah, you know, we didn't really investigate that in depth at all, but we did. I mean, it's certainly something that we came across, and that's been coming in emails quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The story there is that there were put options put on American Airlines and United Airlines stock before 9/11, the idea being that somebody profited from it, therefore somebody had to know. And I think the story puts it in the Chicago issue. I'm not exactly sure the specifics of the story, but
I bet the SEC's looked into it.
Yeah, what I do know is that it was investigated, and it turns out that the put options were not just American Airlines and United Airlines, as the conspiracy sites say.
Oh.
It was I think five or six different airlines, because if you go back to early September of 2001, the airlines were not in good shape to begin with, and there was a lot of talk that there was going to be a pretty big downturn in the aviation stock. But there was some one of these investor newsletters came out and said, you know, aviation is just, you know, going bad. Period. This is trending for months. I mean, this goes back months of trends. So a bunch of people dumped the stock. And then there was an actual flurry of trading, I believe, on these two airlines. But from what I've read, and this is, again, outside of the scope of what we did, that was all pretty solidly debunked well before we got into this, because the trading happened overseas. And, you know, theoretically, the Bin Laden family does have quite a bit of money, and who knows who was making those trades, but it wasn't in the U.S.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ben Chertoff. Hello.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning.
Hey, kudos. What a wonderful job. Thanks for bringing this fine man on your program.
You're very welcome.
And I want to thank you, Ben, for reminding. I'm a former Marine Corps veteran, Gulf War veteran, and I want to thank you for reminding us that my brothers and our American families didn't go over there just to fight over oil. And for all you callers out there, please give these men some respect here. If you can't contain your composure, pick something else up other than a phone. Now, saying that, Art, you posed an interesting question. You know, we want to find out, why do people want to believe like this? Why do we have conspiracy theorists? And why don't they want to trust our government? Now, you yourself...
Well, I'm not sure that everybody should trust the government. People in our business should be keeping an eye on the government, but that doesn't mean that everything that the government does is a conspiracy against the people.
Exactly. But that is a question that does need to be addressed, you know, as far as, you know, that part of the process, why people are like this. And you yourself had a remarkable experience being some kind of a triangle craft.
Yes.
You know, and we have the agenda, that the UFO agenda, of course, and our government's not talking about. And we have the agenda of the chemtrails, our government.
All right, well, these are all different.
So I can understand why we have this kind of a situation here. And the freedom of mobility, I think, is, you know, the heart of the UFO matter because of the propulsion system.
All right, that's another show, sir. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much, but I'm going to keep trying to keep on track here. You're on the air, Coast to Coast AM with Ben Chertoff. Hello.
Hello, is this me?
Dick, I had to cut that out. We don't allow last names.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
So your name is Dick. We'll start over so we get it in. Your name is Dick. And
I'm one of the conspiracy theorists who was one of the very first ones who came out when the security camera video at the Pentagon was released. And that convinced me. And it was completely data-driven, my conclusions, and I put got the photographs out and put them on the Internet. And I just wanted to say that the Popular Mechanics article didn't address it at all. Yet I believe it is one of the most popular, one of the most persuasive of the arguments. Basically, it's two things. The security camera video that was released shows a smaller plane. It also shows a very thick, creamy cloud of trail of which we presume is a missile because it's too thick for contrail, heading toward the Pentagon.
So you think it was a missile, not an airplane?
I believe, the scenario that I have, and Professor A.K. Dudney, who's an editor of Scientific American, the view is that the Pentagon, the 757 was there, and it flew over the Pentagon and landed at Reagan National Airport only 1 mile away beyond. The killer jet was an F-16 or some other fighter jet that is smaller and differently proportioned, and that is based not on speculation, but the proportions are based on the security camera video.
Okay,
that's,
Ben.
That's based on the 5 frames of video that you see and still repeated all over again. There's one frame where you can see the plane. I mean, you're basing it on that one still, correct?
Yes.
I'll tell you what you have in there. Of course, the nature of security cameras like that to save data and to save space on whatever recording device they're using, it's not a full motion video. So you've got, I don't know how many frames per second that was, but it's fewer than 30 frames a second, probably closer to 10 or maybe even fewer than that. So you have this one shot of a blurred, completely, because of course it's not a fast shutter, so you've got this blur on the screen. You can
mm-hmm.
barely see what it is, whether it's a plane, whether it's a 757, whether it's an F-16. I think there is by far enough empirical evidence to say that is, in fact, a 767.
Well, besides, it wasn't F-16 parts and pieces,
yeah.
Or a missile from an F-16.
Or a black box from an F-16.
None of that was true.
Exactly.
I mean, you may wish to believe these things, folks, but please, the facts are the facts, and, they're pretty well documented in this article. Is there any other good reading that you would recommend to people who are the few out there that might be teetering or tottering one way or the other and haven't made up their minds?
To go beyond this?
Yes.
There's a lot of bad mouthing about the 9/11 Commission report, and I certainly, I don't want to say that everything came out there as clearly as it could have. I mean, I think they did a pretty Herculean task. It was an independent commission. Go through the footnotes in the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, if you're really serious about this, because you see what they saw, and you get pointed to the actual source material. People fault the report for not having enough evidence. Well, it's all there. It's just in about 60 pages of footnotes in the back. And, we certainly did our share of that among all the other reporting we had. But there's a lot of stuff in there. And it's overwhelming the amount of evidence that there is for the events played out the way most people really saw them played out.
Okay, Ben, this is a part of the show here where I have to ask now if you want to give out your home number. Listen, buddy, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
And I doubt that we changed any seriously made-up minds, but I appreciate your bringing the sanity and the facts to the program and taking the time to stay up late to do it on top of that. Thank you.
That was a lot of fun. I hope everyone, if you have any questions, go out and pick up Popular Mechanics. It's still on the newsstand now, and please give it a read.
Good night, my friend.
Thank you. Good night.
Take care. See you all tomorrow night. Crystal, as always, with the right words to carry us out of here. From the high desert, the green high desert, good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. The longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?